Well, it's 9:02. We call this meeting of the Board of Pharmacy to order. As a means of roll call, what we'll do is we'll go around the table and say your name and what your position is on this board.
I'm Susan Fry, Vice Chairman of the Board of Pharmacy, pharmacist from Villista, Iowa.
Ed Meyer, pharmacist member of the board from Hapleton, Iowa.
Peggy Whitworth, a public member of the board from Cedar Rapids.
Debbie Jorgensen, board staff.
I'm Becky Hall, board staff.
Jim Wolf, compliance officer.
Ray Burson, compliance officer.
Scott Galenbeck, assistant attorney general.
Terry Witkowski, board staff.
Lloyd Jessen, board staff.
Mark Anlicker, pharmacist member from Emmitsburg.
Ann Deal, public member from Osceola.
I'm Vern Benjamin, I'm the chairman of the board from Argyle. First, I want to thank Lloyd and all the office staff for all the work that's been done on this project this far. It's been a long process up till now. Also want to thank anybody that spoke at the forums that we had in the four different locations and all the input that we've got. I'd like to thank those that submitted data and information. We've got a lot of information from people other than at those meetings to help us in our decision making. So it took a lot of effort to get to this point, and if you saw our boxes or box of material, you would see how much material was collected. Besides, there's several CDs in the box that had a lot of other information other than just the printed material. We need to announce too that this is a public meeting, but what the input from the public into our decision making has ended, and today it's a discussion among the board members, and comments from the public are not going to be admitted into our decision making. And if anyone has to be reminded more than once of that, then Luke, our high patrolman in the back room, will escort you out of the room. So just to try to keep it peaceful and so that it goes forward in a manner that we all want to have it do. So what we have is a list of 13 points which we as a board she just wrote cell phones. That'd be probably a good idea. Everybody make sure that their cell phone is on vibrate so we don't get that interruption. We have 13 points that the law requires us to make a decision on when we schedule a controlled substance. And what we're going to do is we're going to discuss each one of them as we go down the list, have input from the board members, get their opinion, and then at the end of the discussion of those things, then we would get to a point where we should be able to get a vote on the issue of whether we want to reschedule marijuana out of Schedule 1. So the first one that's on the list is marijuana. Is marijuana actual? What is marijuana's actual or relative potential for abuse? So open the discussion up. Anybody want to jump in? This discussion is going to go real fast.
I won't be here all day.
Well, I guess I'll start it out. I do think that the literature has shown us that there is potential for abuse. We've had numerous reports, follow-up reports from the states that currently have medical marijuana, that, you know, there have been abuses to this, not only with the medication, but to the system. And I think that is an encompassing factor that we need to consider as we're doing this deliberation.
The struggle in my mind is whether it's got a greater potential for abuse than other medications that we've got in class 2 at this point. And I've been tossing that around since I started reading through that 30-pound box of information. Waiting to see how the discussion goes on that issue.
You know, the fact that it is, it does alter the mind's perception to pain by affecting, you know, the pain receptors that it does alter the mind's perception to pain. So therefore, it does have, in my opinion, a potential for abuse.
We've got a lot of literature that spoke to that point, and I think probably one of the things that all of us have had to mull over in our minds is that there are things that are on the market right now that have a potential for abuse, and alcohol being something that's legitimate still has a lot of abuse of it, have a lot of negative effects, but it is something that's allowed to be used by the general public. Most of the opiates that are on the market have probably a higher potential for abuse than what the marijuana does because of the, I would say, the addiction potential for that. And part of the abuse of some things is, as long as it's illegal, it's probably going to be abused because it offers that incentive for people that can't use it to use it just by the fact that it is illegal. Like when in order to drinking age to 18 and 19 year old kids probably didn't seek it as much because then it wasn't like skirting the law. So I think definitely with all that we've seen in the literature, the pile that we had on the adverse effects of marijuana, was probably number two behind other medications. The alcohol being the first one that has the most potential abuse, and then probably the narcotic drugs, and then marijuana after that. So it probably does have potential, but probably not as much as some of the other drugs that are available by prescription today.
I think, as I read through, that I see that there is definitely potential for abuse. The question I have, much like Mark, is what's the relative potential there? However, I do look at the track record in states like California, where it's evident that there's been some abuse even of the system that's been put in place there. And most of that is because of the abuse of this system, which is bound to happen. So I think it's very important to have some controls.
I think it's two different things if we're talking about abuse of medical marijuana or marijuana, and the abuse of a system that may have been put in place because they are two vastly different factors. And I think our discussion, you know, certainly acknowledging here that particular issue. But I think that we need to look in terms of the questions here. And the system of delivery, should a change be made, is an entirely different issue here.
No, I'm sort of like Mark. I've seen alcohol abused, and I've seen marijuana abused, and I've seen prescription drug abuse. And reading through the literature, it's hard for me to discern which has the most potential for abuse. I'm speaking as a person who was I'm the age where it was not available to me when I was a young person, so we got into my dad's alcohol. Then by the time marijuana, I didn't even know what it was then. By the time it became available, I had two young children and wasn't interested in doing anything like that. So I'm still wrestling with... I'm not wrestling with the fact that it can has a potential for abuse, because I think anything that makes you feel good and you can get does have potential. Whether or not it's whether or not it exceeds the drugs on Schedule 2, I'm not sure. And I'm open to hear more from the rest of the board.
Okay. Anything else on that? We'll go to number two. Marijuana's pharmacological effect. So basically what it's asking there is the pharmacological profile of the negative effects of the medication such that it would be classified as a Schedule 1, which means there is no pharmacological reasoning for using the medication, or is there stuff to show that there is pharmacological effect that's positive? Go to Sue again.
All right.
Right around the table.
Okay. In this, I feel the information stated very clearly the concerns of the adverse effects, particularly those of paranoia and the effect that it has on younger brains. I was very interested, I found that very fascinating and found the information very helpful on that. In that, it in the studies that we looked at, there are effects, ill effects on all products. The smoked marijuana, oral marijuana, oral THC, they all have adverse reactions. They all have similar effects. A lot of them are dose dependent. But there again, we come with, when we're looking at the raw product, we have no way of standardizing that dose. And that, to me, is a problem. That would be enough for me to say that it still needs to have, that it needs to remain in Schedule 1. As you're looking at the criteria for at the federal level to change a medication from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2, one of the first things is that it has to be reproducible, that the product has to deliver the same thing each time. And with the raw product of cannabis, that reproducibility is not there. And so I, as a health professional, I would have a difficult time recommending that therapy, because I couldn't guarantee that the patient would get the same effect each time.
I think Sue probably brought up my concerns in this situation is the reproducibility of the pharmacological effects. There definitely are under certain cases, there are some positive effects, but they're also, along with that, we're looking at some negative side effects that are a concern. And the biggest thing is that is the reproducibility. You know, it's just inherent with that plant, with that botanical, that there's not, you know, each plant is going to be different. And trying to and there are several, as the states have struggled with that, the ones that have made it legal, how big a dose, how much do you allow because the dose is not reproducible. there are several states that struggle to say how much do we allow because it's hard to reproduce that effect. That's a concern.
I certainly agree with that in terms of what is a dose and how is that how would that occur? And I think that's simply one of the realities of dealing with the issues, and that is one of the unknowns.
In that stack of literature that we looked at, I looked at far more rat and mouse studies than I have in a number of years. And the whole cannabinoid receptor issue, that's pretty much a given in my mind. You get effects in humans. So I guess I really narrowly looked at number two as that's a straight yes or no kind of answer. Those other issues we do need to discuss, obviously, that they're part of the larger picture, but there's a definite pharmacologic effect in my mind in humans with smoking.
Okay.
I
would go along with that. I really don't hear anything to add. I think probably when I looked at this particular point, my thought was that in a lot of the literature where the doctors are making comments about the negative effects of the medication, and that one of the main things that they're talking about is the fact that it's right now in the smoked product, you're having the marijuana smoked at a temperature where it's burning the product, creating tars in the system. They said that the tar was like four times as much that you got from a marijuana cigarette as from a regular cigarette. And when you take that into the fact that when they are smoking marijuana, the whole intent to get more absorption is to keep it in the lungs longer. So therefore, you're having the product in the lungs longer, allowing it to have more of an effect, negative effect from that. So most of the literature where the doctors are actually making a recommendation, they're recommending to find an alternate delivery system. Most of them that are doing anything right now are saying that the preferred method is to use a vaporizer where you don't get the burning of the product. You get the oils and resins coming up into a vapor form and breathe. There was some discussion where that type of delivery system versus the smoking was not as effective because you could take a couple hits off the joint if you feel good and you could just quit. Well, the exact same thing is true about the vapors. If you get the relief that you want, you just stop. The product that's taken orally, which is by prescription, is a medication where you take it, you ingest it, and you get a set dose. There is no titrating, I guess you'd say, of the effect of the medication. So it's a set dose. The products that are on the market that have the THC in them, one of them is an oral mucosa where you put it, apply it right into the mouth. It's absorbed readily, but you don't have any of the burning. And without them knowing exactly what all the ingredients are of the smoke that is being inhaled from a cigarette, it's pretty hard to tell what is causing the pharmacological effect. But the THC and the, I can't think of the chemical name, the other ingredient that they put together in the product is
CBD.
Cannabidiol.
Yes.
If you have those two in combination, you get better results. There again, too, what they're trying to do is do the research to make sure that they have the active ingredients, determine what it is, and a delivery system that'll work, that'll be able to be recommended by the doctors, that they won't have the qualms about writing something that might do damage as well as help the individual. Anybody else? third one on the list is current scientific knowledge regarding marijuana. Some of these things are going to start getting to be redundant because we're going to talk about them, but let's just like that.
Okay. To be real honest, I was amazed at the amount of information that came about. That being said, there are a couple of things that I did find problematic in the information that we received. First of all, the studies that were done were very small studies. And you had a lot of people that were excluded from studies. We didn't know what the sample size was. Sometimes we didn't know statistics. We didn't always have complete information. And so I found that a little problematic. I also found problematic the fact that we were given a lot of information of oral versus smoked, in that, you know, you're talking about different delivery systems, and so they work differently. Your effect might be a little different. So that I sort of had to sort that through that a little bit. The one thing that I was impressed with, though, is that I think the oral THC products have been getting a lot of bad rap. And in the studies, I have been impressed that actually given the appropriate dosing and with appropriate monitoring, that they can be just as effective or more effective. It's taught me that in my practice, we're probably not dosing it appropriately. And so I learned something new from that Medicare, from this information. So I think that we need to do more work on using that medication better. I think we need to do more education with physicians to use the oral THC in a more appropriate way. And I think that the other problem that I had, particularly when I was looking at the studies with glaucoma, is that those studies singled out particular active ingredients of the marijuana plant, different ingredients. And so it was more difficult to say that, yes, as a whole, it was effective, because the studies that we looked at were, you know, effect might go from 4 minutes to, you know, several hours. And so that was, that you're not comparing apples to apples in those cases. So, but I was overall impressed with the amount of scientific knowledge that was prepared and presented to us. But I did have some reservations in the quality of that information.
I guess I would echo what Sue says. I think that there was certainly a lot of information there, and some of it was very good. As I read it, if you've ever had some training in how to look at scientific literature, a lot of those studies were small. A lot of them, that makes it very difficult. The power of the study then is not as good as it would be had we had a larger sampling of people. The other thing that I noticed is a good many of those were a comparison of marijuana to placebo, to something that has no effect. There was an overall lack of a comparison of marijuana to present treatment modalities. Things like, you know, a comparison like in glaucoma of marijuana to Timoptic or one of the eye drops that's used presently. How effective is it in comparison? There's You know, is it better? Is it worse? Those kinds of things were not very well addressed in the literature we had. So that was a concern. I think there was a lot of stuff there, and I think it needs to be looked at seriously and longer.
I would agree in terms of looking at the whole issue more seriously and longer. One of the things that hit me on all of these studies is because medical marijuana or marijuana is illegal, the whole issue of how do you study the illegal substance without breaking the law? And I think that there is a real barrier to understanding medical marijuana because research cannot occur as it ordinarily would. Obviously, much of what we read was certainly challenging for a non-scientific reader. And I really have great admiration for the scientists who are doing this work and wish them well and hope they continue. But just the nature of how the studies are done, they are so targeted, so isolated. And I think that always there could be, we would like to have more information. But to me, that real thing that hit me, there is a lot of information, there is need for a lot more research, and the barrier because it is illegal in how the research can occur.
I find myself this morning wishing I had sorted the stacks of information, you know, whether it was provided by the public, provided by the board, regardless of its source. I wish I'd sorted it into two piles, smoke marijuana and cannabis-based medications, because the vast, vast majority of what we received is cannabis-based medications, and that's not what we're dealing with this morning. We're dealing with smoke marijuana. The smoke marijuana studies, to my recollection, specifically in glaucoma and nausea, talked about older medications. There were very limited information with smoke marijuana versus azofrane danacrona. We're talking Algol, we're talking prochlorperazine. There were some significant dosages of dexamethasone in some of the studies. So that's more current than the other. But that I found a little disappointing and disconcerting. The glaucoma with the cannabis-based medications, some of the eye drops, I noticed they were using pumps, which, you know, microliter kinds of drops continually into the various animal eyes that they were doing these studies on, which addresses my original concern about length of effect of those medications. Did notice that in the pain medications, the currently available marijuana tends to have a biphasic response on the pain relief. And again, we deal with all kinds of pharmacologic effects, but I thought it was interesting that you get a biphasic pain relief reaction. Maybe that's a point for smoke because it's easier to titrate than the orals, but that's part of the whole discussion I'm having in my mind this morning.
I'm not sure what you mean by biphasic.
Lower doses, let's see, low dose in the study, I think I'm recalling, had no effect. A medium kind of dose in that study potentiated opioids. The higher dose actually made the people hyper. They got more pain than they did, more pain from the painful stimuli that they were using in the study than they did from the normal dose.
You have anything else? I was looking for this one page and I found it's on my. And this is hard to find the page you're thinking about in all the stuff that we have, but I'm in this one article that it said the Controlled Substance Act schedules certain types of classes of substances, not specific products. And although the new branded medications undergo a scheduling analysis as part of the FDA approval, placement of the substance in Schedule 2 is not sufficient to allow
a specific product containing the substance to be marketed and distributed directly to the patient. Basically, what that's saying is if something was put into Schedule 2, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's been approval for that product to be used. It goes on to say that then the DEA has to determine whether it has acceptable medical use, and then it has to determine from all the studies of qualified experts and scientific evidence that the product actually is a product that can be approved by the FDA. So I guess as far as scientific knowledge regarding marijuana, I think that's part of what a lot of the scientists and that out there are asking for, is for us to reschedule it off of Schedule 1 so that they can have access to it, so they can do the studies, so they can develop the products that they feel will target a specific medical problem. And I guess this one paragraph here kind of, I think, explains a lot of what the rationale and the reasoning why we are trying to do what we're trying to do. Is a lot of the people want to do experimentation on it, but they're holding back because of the fact that it is a C1. So.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the FDA can approve studies on something.
Yes, they could actually provide the marijuana. If somebody wanted to do a study, the FDA could actually give them, legally give them marijuana to study.
What's the process to get that approved to do it, though?
I haven't done that before.
Yeah. Actually, I think it's the DEA that provides the marijuana.
Oh, yeah, they would be the
And it was my understanding, as a Class 1, experimentation can be done on it. Mm-hmm. So that process, that's how they get those people that have done the research, that's how they have obtained it. Is through going through the DEA process to allow for study on a Class 1 medication. I don't think we have to reschedule it to Class 2 in order for experimentation. That's already, that process is already in place.
But that's one of the criteria that a lot of the experimenters are saying. If it would be a Schedule 2, they'd be able to do their experiments a whole lot more.
I think one of the comments that I read somewhere is that you are able to get it from the DEA, but it has become a very difficult application process, and very few of those applications are approved.
Number 4 on our list is the history and current pattern of abuse of marijuana. So basically, it's two things there. It's what's the history of marijuana? Has it been used in the past? And then what's the current use of it and abuse that we see today? So, put pressure on Sue again.
She's doing fine. She can handle it.
Well, actually, I think if anywhere that our information was probably lacking, this is probably the one area that it was lacking in. I mean, we all have, historical part of it. I mean, basically, the information has just been looking at, or has been over and over, that it was taken off the Federal Register by the FDA. We really didn't have any information, or I didn't find any information that addressed that historical abuse. Nor did I, outside of, I think, that one piece of information from the FDA that talked about the current pattern of abuse, where they were mainly talking about adverse reactions, that they are seeing an increase admissions to our mental health facilities or mental health services because of adverse reactions. And I think maybe, if I recall, there was something from California information that they were seeing an increase in the number of prescriptions that were used in a younger, healthier population than what was expected. That's what I recall for information on that subject.
I really don't have a lot to add to that. This was disappointing to me that we didn't have better information about what's actually happening in the patterns of abuse. And of course, the argument can always be made that, you know, it's abused because it's classified the way it is. So anytime anybody uses it, it's a circumstance of abuse. But I did catch that one part that it's interesting in California that the users, there's a really high group of younger, healthy people who are using it. Medical marijuana. So that's an interesting kind of piece of information.
I think this whole issue is surrounded by myths and stereotypes. I think that there are overwhelming cultural implications and have been historically tied very much to racial and ethnic biases. Generationally, there are significant changes in attitudes. I think that we don't have a lot of historic reference. It is also fraught with political and ideological implications of when things are moved through the system and something is moved from schedule to schedule and the laws change. And I don't know that the Board of Pharmacy is necessarily the best place to get the thorough cultural history of some of these products. But it is that, I think, is a very real issue. And that is not going to show up, and the implications are not going to show up in terms of any of our scientific studies. It also is having more than a bit of emphasis here in what we are studying today and what we're discussing. And the whole idea of that there are, definitely we all have our biases. Some people are freer to admit them than others, but they are in fact biases. And we all have, our own cultural baggage. I think there is great confusion in the discussion now that we're here to legalize marijuana, which we are not. We are here to basically handle almost a technical adjustment in a legal process. And that is certainly something in anyone looking to write a dissertation in a number of different disciplines, I would encourage them to consider this, and then we can add to our scientific knowledge, because that it's simply something we don't have. It wasn't in the material. That is not a criticism of how the material was gathered or anything else, but we certainly are surrounded by myths and stereotypes in this, as in many other issues.
That's the public member speaking. I don't think it has anything to do with the amount of material that's gathered. The material's probably not there.
Well, much of it is not.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I would totally
fortunate.
Agree.
It's just not.
Yeah. I go along with what Peggy said. There are huge implications, huge amounts of energy with this whole discussion. One easy way for me to pigeonhole it was alcohol prohibition. It's illegal, and all of a sudden it's a panacea. It's everybody wants it, and I think there's a fair amount of comparison there. Is that a straight up comparison? No, but in my mind, there's a tie together in that issue.
I'm pretty much along with what Peggy said, too. There's so much of this myth and cultural attitude mixed in with what we have that it's hard to look at it. I have found it very interesting just people coming up to me on the street in little Osceola and saying, first, like you said, how are you going to change that law? And then I explained that we're not going to change the law. But there doesn't seem to be any happy medium in opinions. It's you better do it this way or you better do it that way.
Yeah,
I've been surprised at the responses with the people that I've known for years that I've never discussed this with.
I think we will be evil no matter what.
I think so.
We've been called a lot of names already, no matter what we do. We will probably be called some of the same, but probably some new ones.
It might be nice.
I hope they get more creative. The last names are so predictable.
This is sort of like the divorce proceeding. There's just her story, and then there's that middle ground, which is the truth.
You were right about the amount of history that was in here. There wasn't much, but if you do take what is available, just because of the fact that they didn't write about these drugs didn't mean that they weren't being used. I think that there were several different places where it made reference to the use of marijuana throughout history and how it particularly wasn't that big of a problem in society until, I forget who this said, politically,
yeah.
And I guess it was Peggy that said about being politically and ideologically a wrong thing to do. I think there is a pattern of history for it that up until that point it wasn't that big of a problem, and I think it currently is being abused just because of the fact that it is illegal. It's just like I made a comment earlier about the young kids trying to get the alcohol. It's if it's illegal, it's going to be something that they're going to seek after probably. And then in the California situation with as soon as the federal government said they weren't going to be pressing so hard because of medical users, the average age of the user in California went from 42 down to 24, which means that still all those older people are still in the mix, but there has to be a lot of people under 24 to draw that number down to 24. So I think their situation, the way they have their medical marijuana program set up, leaves an awful lot to be desired, and I would not want to be a board of pharmacy member or anything like that in the state of California. They didn't set their rules and regulations up tight enough to begin with to make sure that their issues didn't become problems.
I think a lot of the stigma, it comes with the, you know, this polarizing thing about people being on one side or the other is the stigma is the recreational use, and we're not looking at recreational use, we're looking at medical use. Unfortunately, there are times when that line becomes blurred, and that's an unfortunate thing, but it has happened when things were not done correctly.
My thought was that of the documentation that we received, the forums were almost 100% for marijuana. The documentation that we received, whether it was emails, letters, communications of any kind, my estimate is someplace 30% or more were just people that wanted to smoke pot. They had no aspirations about this as a medical issue. They just wanted to smoke pot. And it's hard to separate those out because there were some interesting comments from the pot smokers, if you will.
Good that you just said what you just said, because this one other piece that we got, it was a comment from the Institute of Medicine, and it's they stressed that the purpose of the clinical trials of smoked marijuana would not be to develop marijuana as a licensed drug, but rather to serve as the first step toward the development of non-smoked rapid-onset cannabinoid delivery systems. The
FDA agrees that herbal cannabis is not a medication, and that the long-term prospect of smoked herbal cannabis as a medicine is almost nil. So it's probably the easiest way for them to experiment on it is the smoked marijuana now to find out what the ingredients of the smoked marijuana are actually having the effect, but it's probably in the long run, that's not where we're going to, where we have smoked marijuana be a medicine of sorts. It's what it is right now, and what they're trying to do is use the information they gather from the experimentation on the smoked marijuana to develop drugs that actually target specific disease states and at doses where they can become medicine. The scope, duration, and significance of the abuse of marijuana. We've discussed that.
Yeah,
anybody have anything they want to make a comment on that particular?
Four and five were tied together in my mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Number six is probably a big question in a lot of people's mind. The risk to the public health of moving marijuana to a different controlled substance schedule.
I think this also gets to one of those things of what it is we're really dealing with here and the risk to the public health of moving marijuana to a different schedule, I think, is probably not so significant what we're talking about. What is the risk? I mean, what most people are concerned with is what is the risk to public health in terms of the delivery system, the controls, how would all of that be established, and then, of course, taking the leap to the whole legalization of marijuana, which is not what we're dealing with today.
Well, just so everybody in the public realizes what these are, these are criteria that the Controlled Substance Act tells us we have to judge the basis of our decision. So all these things we have to be, say, yes, we agree with all this stuff, that it does fall within the boundaries of these definitions, and therefore we change it to a different schedule. So that's why each one of the points we're discussing individually. So, and I agree too. It's not public health really. It's a small portion of the people that are wanting to use the marijuana for medical purposes. So it's not even.
It's a very valid point, but in terms of the narrow discussion, the narrow issue we're considering today, it is not that
right. Right. If we were talking about scheduling opioids, that's for everybody. This is not going to be for everybody.
Well, I guess I would take a different tact on that.
That's just fine. That's what you're having.
Exactly. I think that in this, as we're making this recommendation, we do have to look at the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is that if you allow for medical marijuana, then that becomes a medicine. There is a risk to public health. If you allow smoked marijuana, then where do you practice that?
Bingo.
Does it practice? Do you? I mean, you can't restrict it to a patient's home. How does that affect? You know, are they going to be? Are we going to allow, a person walking down the street to smoke marijuana?
See, I think that's a real valid point with the change in smoking laws in Iowa recently adopted. There, it's sort of like, yes, you can, however, no, you can't.
Right.
So,
we could not, in my mind, you could not restrict a diabetic patient from injecting themselves in a restaurant. If it's a medical necessity, how do you restrict that use? I think the risk to public health is very valid. If I were a person with young children, I certainly would not want them exposed to someone smoking anything. And so, I think that's a very valid point. I think that's something that we really need to look at, that there is a risk.
Another thing, as I recall, at the Council of Bluffs hearing, we listened to the gentleman from Israel, who was very pro medical marijuana, but you did make one caveat. I would never let anybody drive while using medical marijuana. That's public health. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a public health concern. So, you know, as we do this, and consider this, we have to consider those things that, and a lot of that depends on how it's controlled.
And you are looking at it clearly, public health in the, you know, language has different things, and your points are extremely valid, and I'm glad that you raised them. And, you know, how many substances are there for which you get a doctor's prescription filled at a pharmacy that come with the disclaimer of do not operate heavy machinery? But are the heavy machinery cops out there looking for you when you do it? No, I'm really serious. You know, yeah, how are those things? And I guess we need to, and you can't legislate common sense, which is really unfortunate, because that'd be a good law.
Couple of thoughts. We're not changing the driving under the influence regs. Right? You can still get picked up for alcohol, you can still get picked up for Lortab, those kinds of things. It seems that at least a number of the states had time or place and distance restrictions similar to, I'll use the child abuse registry people, not within so many feet of the school, not on public transportation, not on, there were a number of those caveats in the regulations. And so I think we've got a legitimate issue, but I think it can be dealt with in regulations promulgated by whoever gets to promulgate the regulations.
But unfortunately, those are not things that, if you look at it in a pure sense, that we have in our responsibility. Our responsibility is to decide whether to change it or not. We can make a lot of comments, but our decision is change the schedule. But
I will toss out one thing. Typical hospital campus, you can't smoke on the campus if they've got an oncology floor. And if medical marijuana comes to pass, what do they do?
Mm-hmm. Going to have to use a different.
But those old bunkers that used to be out along the edge of the property where they'd send people to smoke, I don't know. I'm just... Mm-hmm.
I'd say, for me, it'd be what's the relative risk of marijuana to the public health as compared to like opiates. Is marijuana then, if you use it, is it incapacitate you more than what, say, like Vicodin does? Or does Vicodin have more of a sedative effect or so that you can't drive it more? And I think from what I've read is it's probably less negative effects than what you could be dosing yourself on using opioids.
So you're talking strictly to the person who's using it?
To the person using, yes. And I agree, too, that a lot of the states have that in their laws, that they restrict the usage. And I would recommend that whoever the legislator puts together drafts the legislation, if that would be the case, that they would make sure that, and I'm sure that discussion will all be dealt with if it does come to that.
Now, Anna, did you have any other?
Oh, well, I have a question that just all of a sudden popped up in my mind. If we're talking about changing the schedule, are we talking about changing the schedule for smoked marijuana only? How about the mist delivery?
Or
would that
just for marijuana? It doesn't say anything about the delivery system.
Yeah,
it's
just the product.
So you take the whole
marijuana that you offer.
All right. Well, I tend to look at public health in a bigger scope than just the person using it. So, but there again, we're not here to decide how it's managed if we change it, which gives me a little concern.
Okay.
change the schedule.
Okay. We're down to number seven. And number seven is the potential of marijuana to produce psychic or psychological dependence liability.
In one of the studies, I think it was probably addressed very well. It was, and I don't have the particular one to cite, but it was in, they looked at the use of the oral HTC, smoked marijuana, and a placebo. And in that study, I think they were using it on for nausea, that they found that the smoked marijuana and the oral HTC, or THC, sorry, were comparable if the THC was dosed appropriately. And I found interesting in that study that the comment was made that one of the issues that they found was that, number one, either the physician did not ask about the patient's previous marijuana use and the level of that use, or that the patient or the study person, study recipient, was not forthcoming in their previous use, and that because tolerance can be built up, that the reason a lot of times that the oral THC was not effective was because that it wasn't dosed appropriately, because that tolerance level had been, because of previous use, the tolerance level had been built up, and so they were actually underdosed. And once they figured out that issue, then the study came and took a little bit of a different turn, and they realized that the oral THC and the smoked marijuana were actually both effective, and that the immediate relief that has been associated with smoked marijuana was not really any different than a person that was stabilized on the oral THC. And so to answer this question, yes, definitely there is a physiological dependence, because you do have the buildup of tolerance, and it does require eventually it does require more medication to get the same effect. That's not to say that that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I deal with long-term care residents, and I deal with long-term care pain, and we deal with that tolerance, and it's not you know, I don't want to give the impression that I think that that's necessarily a bad thing, that, you know, you're going to have, you know, it's just an escalating thing. That doesn't happen rapidly. It's a slow process. But it does happen, and that's one of the criteria of making a drug either a physiological independence. So I think that was supported in the literature. The psychic dependence, there again,
we didn't have any specific.
We didn't have we didn't really have studies that really looked at that psychological dependence.
I think the other thing that's a bit of a challenge in the way these questions are, these points are made, the potential of marijuana to produce, you could substitute a lot of other words. We are dealing with the other words. We're dealing with that one right now. And that's something that I have to remind myself of.
Okay. Does anybody want about a 5-minute break?
That would be great.
We'll start back up at 10 after 10.
Martin knows I've always been just messing with when you do that.
10:15 at the latest,
okay? Okay, got it.